All right, everyone. Thanks very much for joining for another episode. We're so lucky to have Dr. Audrey Nath with us today. She's a neurologist. I can never do justice to anyone's introduction, so I will let her introduce herself. Audrey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Varun. So I am a pediatric epileptologist, and I'll step back a little bit about how I got into all of that. So I started out at the MD-PhD program here in my hometown at UT Houston. And to be completely honest, I was interested in research. However, the MD-PhD program pays for you to go to medical school. When I was 21 years old and staring down, okay, am I going to take out loans or am I going to get paid $20,000 a year starting in 2005? At that time, it looked like, oh man, that would be great to get paid and have my own income and my own benefits. So I would have to say, I think for a lot of MD-PhD students, I'm not the only one, that financial aspect had a huge impact on my decision to pursue MD-PhD as opposed to MD only. So in any case, I did all of that. With the MD-PhD program, there's pressure in terms of what specialty you choose. You're highly encouraged to choose specialties that are the most conducive for research. So we were told over and over, pathology, internal medicine, neurology would be the best choices. And of those, I liked neurology. And within that, I really enjoyed pediatric neurology and the puzzle of it all. And then the other piece is you're highly encouraged to go to a very academic medical center for your residency, the kind of place where you can get a little bit of funding during residency or right after to do research, in order to then have preliminary data, to get grants when you're an attending, to then have multiple R01, those are the big career grants, in order to run a lab. So it's like this nonstop rat race. I matched at one of the Harvard hospitals for child neurology residency, and I don't regret that. I made some really good friends that are still like family to this day. However, looking back on it, in terms of my clinical interests, I have more interest in community medicine, that just personally, and I knew that in medical school, and I knew this about myself, but I felt, oh gosh, they invested so much in me. I should make everybody proud. And so I went there to this major subspecialized referral center for my residency. And
wait,
then
let's pause before your residency, because you said a lot of stuff to unpack. I am with you. When we are in our 20s, it's so hard to know what the rest of your life is going to look like. I got a little taste of this environment, because I took a year off between third and fourth year, and I went to the National Institutes of Health. So I went to Bethesda, Maryland, and I was in a basic science lab that did eye research on mice. And I saw this all around me. It was like a pressure cooker of publish or perish.
You know what I'm talking about.
And it's interesting. You have an MD, PhD. I don't, because I what came back after my third.
Yeah, but you got a taste of it. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I recently had a medical student reach out to me that's in the middle of their MD, PhD. And they said, listen, I really don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. They're going back to their third year. And they were getting a lot of pressure from, one, their parent, who happens to be a physician. I can't really relate to that because none of my parents are doctors. But and two, they were saying that their deans were flabbergasted that they took up a spot from someone else.
It's because of that guilt when you're in your 20s and you're still developing your identity, and you don't want to be a huge disappointment in life because you think you are, which is wild when clearly every one of these students is highly intelligent and not a failure.
Yeah,
it's really wild to think about.
And I told them that, listen, no one can make this decision for you except you. But I told them that nothing bad is going to happen. If you decide that you don't want to do this, just tell them. I was like, your dad will get over it. They're not the ones that have to live your day-to-day life.
And you're only going to be a doctor. Oh, my goodness.
That's right. And I said, your deans and your medical school will have to figure out what to do about that whole stipend situation. All of that stuff will sort itself out. The big question is, like you alluded to as well, what are you actually going to do with your PhD? And again, this goes back to everything's hindsight in 2020. But I see a lot of people struggling to, not just with PhDs, with MBAs or MPAs. Go into them, spend some money, invest in the time and resources, the money required, and then not have a clear picture of what are you actually going to do with that degree. And sometimes people, I think, overestimate what a degree, what the additional letters after their name do with them. PhDs in basic science research and all of that, the triple threat in your career of clinical medicine, teaching
research.
That's a whole nother ball game, right? Like you were mentioning the R01 grants. That is no joke trying to get some of these grants.
That's right.
But with any degree after an MD or DO or MBBS, it's always like a little bit, I always encourage people to have a plan, right? It's impossible to know 100%. But if you're just like spending $100,000 to get an MBA and you don't know what you're going to do with it, it's probably not a great investment. But okay, so I stopped you in between. Sorry. So you get your residency, and then what happens in residency? But
you are absolutely getting to how the rest of the story goes. So, you know, you're saying that it's important for people to actually see what is your life going to look like? What are your goals? I let a whole bunch of people choose that for me. I don't think I'm the only person in my 20s that has, and now I'm in my 40s looking back and thinking, oh gosh, what was I thinking? But part of the MD-PhD program, so they kind of pressure you a little bit into specialties that are research conducive, certainly highly encouraged to go to very academic residencies. And then beyond that, you're also highly encouraged to subspecialize into a niche, because it's easiest to do research when you're in a smaller niche. And so I did two fellowships, came back to Houston, did a year of clinical neurophysiology, which is basically EEGs and EMGs and sleep studies, and then a year of epilepsy, which was basically more EEGs than epilepsy patients. And then I took all the boards, neurology boards, clinical neurophys boards, epilepsy boards, and I started as an attending. And my goal there, which I had been telling myself was my goal, which I convinced myself was my goal because everyone told me it should be my goal, was, okay, I'm going to be an attending. I'm going to get grants. I'm going to do research and some clinical work. I'm going to start a lab. And I got a very small grant. I didn't get the main grant that you're supposed to get at the stage of your career, the K award. Which there's more to say about that. The grant committee told me they didn't like my mentor. There was a page about me in their evaluation of who gets this grant, this early career grant.
Oh my gosh.
And for me, there were zero negative points about myself and my credentials and my publication record. It had nothing to do with me, which is a pretty amazing thing to realize after 14 years of MD-PhD residency and fellowship. And so I had this little grant, it protected some of my time. I had some specific aims, and then they all comically fell apart at the same time. And then it was time to, do I renew this grant or do I not? And so I made the decision, you know what? I tried. I super duper tried. And I made the decision to leave my full-time academic job, which is definitely not what you're supposed to do. So like you're mentioning with people maybe earlier that are thinking, oh gosh, should I leave the MD-PhD program? Everyone's going to be so disappointed. I even felt that then in my late 30s with two kids. It's funny now that you can still feel like a failure despite achieving so much. It's really silly, the whole thing. So then I transitioned to remote work. What's fortunate within my little subspecialty is that I can do things like read EEGs remotely. That's pretty much the type of work that I've had since then. And I have managed to go back and reclaim research in my life. Instead of it being about impressing other people and getting grants to show that I'm a raging success, now I actually write papers for fun on advocacy topics that I care about. I've been writing about medical neglect in incarcerated individuals, some medical topics now about homeless populations, and it's a ton of fun.
That's fantastic. I'm so impressed that you were able to pull into a lane that was more conducive to your passions and utilizing all of your skills and training. It's really awesome. And it takes guts. It's not easy. I see online so many of our colleagues struggling because they feel like, on the one hand, just like you mentioned, they don't want to disappoint mentors and those them. Yeah. On the other hand, I think, like, for lack of a better term, they feel like they have golden handcuffs as well. People are very scared to leave ivory tower places because they wonder about the stories that will be told or made up about them. Why would you ever leave XYZ? Right? I worked at a couple of quote unquote famous places, you know, 1 year assignments while I was doing global health work. And afterwards, when I got married and lived in New Jersey, I ended up working at a totally no-name place. We were doing important work. There are patients everywhere. These patients need doctors, nurses, you know, PTs, everyone. It was just comical when my physician colleagues would sometimes be like, hey, why would you leave Brigham and go and work at this community hospital? Why would you move to New Jersey? As if like people don't have families that live in New Jersey. But it's funny, not a single patient would say that, right? Because the patient needs the healthcare professional in front of them.
You know, along those lines, I do remember hearing that when I was in the Harvard system, there was another attending physician who didn't have a very good deal at all. I think she didn't have an office despite being an attending. And it's really sad. And we would talk to her about that. Like, wouldn't you leave? And she said, oh, I would never want to work at an outside hospital. So literally everything outside the Harvard system was outside hospital. It's wild. And I will say, like you going and working in a different place, even if it is New Jersey, which is not even that remote at all, I have had a lot of fun doing some locums work in places that need specialists. I did locums once in Idaho and then spent two Christmases in Hawaii. And that was so fun for me. That to me gets to the heart of the kind of clinical work I actually want to do, where instead of being pediatric epileptologist number 18, at Texas Children's Hospital, where I could actually go where I was needed and help people. And that's just so fun. People don't talk about that much in medicine, by the way, that locums is an option.
No, you're absolutely right. You touched on two really important things. One is that like I did some locums work right after I finished residency as well. And I feel like depending on where you go to med school and your residency, or if you do a fellowship, you're only exposed to that culture. Like I trained in the Northeast, and it's a difficult place to be a resident because when we were on ICU rotations and stuff, we used to have to wake up at 5 a.m. if we got any sleep at all and draw labs because the New York City nurses were, I don't know if this is true, but I think
I've heard this.
The union said they weren't allowed to do that or weren't. And then when I went to the West Coast to do some locums, I was like, wow, like California is completely different, like in terms of ancillary services. And then one funny story, I went to rural Maine, like this place called Farmington I'd never heard of before. And everyone was so nice. Like they would have charts lined up for me to sign after all already doing basic stuff. But I feel like a lot of patients have never seen a brown person before I walk into the room. And they're like, again, very polite, so appreciative, but it's definitely like eye-opening to go practice somewhere else for the short term to get an exposure to what's out there, especially if you're at a point of your life where you don't have obligations for kids, dependents, loved ones, and you can do that, or they're willing to come with you.
They came with me. We went to Hawaii twice.
That's awesome. I have a colleague that just moved to Hawaii last year, and he's always sending me pictures, and I'm so jealous. And I married a Jersey girl, and my parents live close now, and we're never leaving South Jersey except for vacation. But I would love to go there.
It's great to experience something different than what you saw in training, like what you're saying, as well as just to see different cultures, different regional attitudes, which can vary wildly, that you wouldn't know unless you lived it. Something else that I was thinking about when you were talking about expectations and obligations and guilt, I guess I can just speak to my own experience. And this is something that I've heard from other people as well. I think for a lot of us whose parents were immigrants, there is an additional pressure just knowing that they came all the way here. They worked super hard. They didn't know the system at all, and they tried their best. So the least I can do is just to try to be a success. And I think that there's a lot of pressure there. I think with people whose parents might be immigrants or people who may have come from lower income families, I've heard similar stories as well. This additional kind of hidden pressure that people don't really talk about that people might be experiencing, especially in their 20s, when your frontal lobe, by the way, is still forming.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That exists all around us, and particular communities, like you said, like I'm Indian, and there's a large number of doctors for whatever reason in the Indian community, and probably 1.3 billion people. I guess it's just a numbers game, but also it's a culture that, like, jokingly, like, values like doctors, lawyers,
you know,
something, engineers, and a lot of my colleagues that were in medical school with me, their parents were doctors. My parents aren't doctors, but some of them had passions outside of medicine. Oh, and you could tell that they really did not want to be there. They went through these series of steps because that was just the expectation. And they turned out to be fine physicians, but I can still tell now that we're in our 40s, there's still like this, oh, I wish I had done this or that, or you hear these stories, right? And yeah. Some people, look, medicine is such a diverse field that you can pivot and carve out your own niche. That's no one is going to force you to be in clinic 40 or 60 hours a week.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like if you wanted to be an artist or a photographer, it's difficult to do that.
Yes, agree.
There's also like this, a lot of people have loss aversion. And once you get used to a particular salary, it's very difficult to go back to something else.
So many things about that. This is something I think about a lot, is that there can be a tendency, I think, with every bump in salary to increase your cost of living. And I think this is something that's really common, and maybe our generation is starting to become more aware of. But I think that's absolutely a trap. So you have a bump in salary. Okay, we're going to move into the bigger house. Another bump in salary. Okay, we're going to get an extraordinary amount of household help with a whole bunch of salaries, until all of a sudden you can't go down on that salary, and it becomes a trap. And the thing is, you don't necessarily appreciate that stuff more, because there's like luxury habituation or whatever, where it becomes a new normal and isn't really that special anymore. And so at the end, you make way more money and you're not necessarily happier. And I think we see this a lot and we don't talk about it. And I think that perhaps in the last generation, that was just a foregone conclusion. Okay, you make more money, you got to get in the bigger house. And there's times that even my dad has said that, oh, well, you can get in a bigger house. And I said, wait a minute, why? We have plenty of space. So I think that can absolutely be a hidden trap. And if you don't think about it, it can happen so easily.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Lifestyle creep is just there, so real. Yeah. And you can outspend any level of income. It's really not that hard, especially like what's happened with mortgage interest rates the past 2 years.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And car interest rates for car loans. I'm just making up numbers here, but if you have a partner that earns money as well, or even if you're not, most doctors, if you just Google what is the average physician salary, it's inching up like towards the high 200s. I realize that there are certain, unfortunately, underpaid primary care specialties like pediatrics that are making much less than that. But there's also like specialized surgeons like neurosurgeon and ortho that are making like high six figures.
That's right.
But for most physicians who are employed and don't own their own businesses, you're going to be in one of the highest tax brackets. So every dollar you earn, basically like 40 cents is gone. Yeah. Then if you ever go out and spend a dollar, you have sales tax, right? So I just like to tell people, quick and dirty math, you can expect that 50% of your money will be like gone, right?
Yeah, for sure. And to retirements and saving and all that should happen too. Exactly. Yeah.
So now with like the way that mortgage interest rates have gone up from 2.5% to 7%, people are still getting into bidding wars about these houses. For some reason or another, every single brand new car now, instead of being $30,000, now is like $50,000. Mm-hmm. And Americans love their big SUVs, these like giant Escalades and whatnot. They all start at $80,000. It's really, as a doctor, if you feel the pressure to keep up with the Joneses, you can burn through your attending income and not save any money for retirement.
Very fast. Absolutely. And then if you have multiple shifts of household help, for example, paying a bunch of salaries can happen so quickly. I've heard a lot of stories about that. And then you're not necessarily happier at the end of it. So I think it's a matter of, what do I really need? And taking away all those other expectations, that what you talked about, keeping up with the Joneses, absolutely. And just taking away, what do I care about? Who am I? It was actually really the bigger question here. And does that need to be reflected in that brand new car or that house in that ritzy neighborhood? Or does that actually matter to me? Do I actually care? Is something that I think we all need to think about a little bit.
No, absolutely. And I don't think I've talked about this on any other podcast, but it's funny. When I first became an attending, I went out and bought myself a BMW 3 Series, but I was smart enough to buy a certified pre-owned one. So if you get a pre-owned one, it's 3 years old, and that most of the depreciation's already happened. So instead of being like $55,000, it was like $35,000.
Okay. You know? That's a better deal.
But what I've realized is that buying a luxury car, the maintenance has been atrocious on it since then. And every single car mechanic I've talked to has just shrugged their shoulders and said, Japanese cars have the least maintenance. And then now I look at a lot of physician forums and people talk about their Toyotas and Hondas.
Yep,
and,
that's what I got, yeah.
And it gets them from point A to point B, right? If not that any of us aren't allowed luxury goods. If you value, that's great. But I feel like I wasn't a very educated consumer. I didn't realize that. Okay, once the car purchase is done, guess what? There's going to be a whole host of other things that you have to deal with forever. Yes.
And if you have kids, by the way, my car is just filled with popcorn at this point. So there's no point in it being a super nice car. Yep. And toys and slime. You know, so if I had something really fancy, it would be trashed by now.
Yeah.
That's I don't know if your kids have gotten into your BMW.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It looks like organized chaos all the time.
So. That was not your plan for your BMW, but that's what happened.
Definitely not. That's the other thing. Life in your 20s, you can't imagine your life in your 30s and 40s. You think you can, but you really can't
until it happens. And I've got to say, along those lines, house maintenance can be really significant. Changing out a roof, repairing stucco in the south here, all of that can be tens of thousands of dollars that you might recoup when you sell your house and you might not. And I think it's okay. You just need to know that. I'm okay with that. I love my house. It's cool. But I don't think I knew that when I bought the house.
No, absolutely. That's the other thing about home ownership. Again, going back to my parents being immigrants, there's a real visceral, you need to own your own house. That shows that you've made it. But also there's an emotional aspect. We own our own house now as well. We have a mortgage, but I kid around with my wife. I show her some articles sometimes of the rent versus buy. And it's not so clear,
in
a lot of cases, and especially for these younger attendings coming out now with like prices at record highs, mortgage interest rates at record highs, and exactly what you were saying, the extra costs, it's not just the price of your mortgage, it's the maintenance, it's the repairs. And then I'm not sure I even understood conceptually before I became a homeowner that like, even if you strike gold and pay off your mortgage, property taxes are never going to go away.
That's so right.
Depending on what part of the country you live in, New Jersey is a very high cost of living state. Our property taxes are almost like some people's rent, like a 2 or 3 bedroom somewhere else. Yeah. So it's crazy. Like it adds up one after another.
And you touched on something else there, is that how wildly cost of living can vary between different places. But you know, sometimes there's family reasons and other reasons outside of your control. Maybe you're married and your spouse needs a specific job in a certain industry. That means that, yeah, you need to live in that high cost of living area. Because I've heard some other financial advice in other places. Sometimes it's just move to the middle of nowhere, obviously. And then maybe they're paying higher salaries to attract people and your cost of living's low. Bam, done. But that's not necessarily an option, especially I think for the two body problem where both spouses need to find work in their industries.
You need to be in a big city
for that.
Yeah, everyone's life situation is going to be completely separate. For us, I grew up in Australia. I think I only saw my grandparents probably a dozen times in my entire life because the flight from Australia to India was so long. And now my wife and I have decided to live close to our parents and our family. So my kids get to see their grandparents every week.
Yeah.
That's like a conscious decision, but you're right. There are definitely a lot of parts of the country. There's 5 or 6 states that don't have state income tax and some of the Midwest and some other areas, the cost of living is definitely much lower. If you have the flexibility to do that, more power to you.
Sure.
I didn't have the flexibility to do it.
Like your Indian parents aren't going to move there.
Actually, hilariously, they would probably go wherever I went. But my wife is like South Jersey Italian and they are not leaving. They live within a 15-mile radius of each other. So it's like an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond. There's like knocks on doors and hey.
And that's a real thing. And that's a real intangible benefit
that
goes beyond cost of living and taxes and money. So there's more to these decisions than just like the salary and the income tax. And it's just something that I think when I was a student, I wasn't thinking about at all.
Yeah, that's right. I like to ask all my guests about like how sometimes having gone through this entire path, you know, our immediate concerns are like taking tests, passing boards, doing this, and our whole personal lives go on the back burner. One of the mistakes I talk about is my student loans. I never did anything like catastrophic, get myself into credit card debt, but I definitely didn't have a good student loan repayment strategy. I wish I'd looked into public service loan forgiveness, or at least had like a plan, because it took me like 9.5 years to pay off my loans. If I had some sort of plan, I might have been able to do it a little bit sooner. But did you, one of our other colleagues likes to talk about getting tricked into buying whole life insurance. Some other people come on the podcast and talked about spending problems. Is there anything that like you look back on and want to tell other people that are earlier in their career about finances or about financial wellness or anything at all that comes to mind?
Thankfully, I didn't buy a whole life policy, first off. But going back to the beginning of my story, when I was 21 years old and applying to medical school and MD-PhD programs, they pay you. And essentially, in my mind at that time, I thought, wow, I won't have to take out loans and I'll get paid. Oh, that is the clear financial winner over taking out loans. But now thinking about this, had I gone to my state school, and in Texas, we're very fortunate to have a number of state medical schools. And if you're a Texas resident, the tuition is much lower than a private school. So if I had actually taken out loans to cover the tuition and my living expenses at that time, I could have paid that off with knowing what my salary is now. And just financially speaking, in the PhD years, where sure, you're making whatever it was at the time, $20,000 a year, but you're also losing out on that many years of attending salary, which now I know is a lot more than that. And it's particularly if you're not in academics, way more than that. It's the kind of thing where at 21 years old, it seemed like, oh, if I take this stipend and I don't have debt, I will come out financially ahead. But now actually running the numbers, that's not necessarily the case. And something that I would not have understood then, probably even if you had told me. I just couldn't see past those next few years and the next test, right? It's always, I feel like my whole life, like you were saying, was just defined by the next test. Seriously, in med school, the next shelf exam, and then the next USMLE exam, and then even into residency, the in-training exams. Until finally, I took my neurology board exam and I got the result back. And that was actually a moment of, oh my goodness, I could just be done now. I could just get a job. I don't actually have to keep doing all these like other things for other people. There was like a little realization moment there. And I think that started the process of me thinking, what do I actually want to do? And I was 36 years old at this point.
Yeah. No, it's very hard to know as you're going through it. And sometimes you just look around you and you do what everyone else is doing. Like I went to an internal medicine residency program in Manhattan, and there were like 30 something of us. And I feel like most people went into cardiology or GI. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of people on a primary care track, like 5 or 6 people. And then there were like 2 people like me. We're just like, we're just going to do locums work. And people looked at us like we had 2 heads.
Fantastic.
You know, even though we were going to graduate from the same residency program, yes, a few months later, like after we passed our boards, we would be board certified in internal medicine. Yes. But there was, even now, it's funny. Again, my parents aren't medical people, but they're like, them or one of their friends or someone will always sometimes allude to, hey, do you ever wish you had gone and done a cardiology fellowship? And I'm like, no, I do not. Because I already left one specialty. I did a year of ophthalmology and I changed my
really?
Mind. Yeah, I did a prelim year in medicine, then I did a PGY2 year in ophthalmology, and it just wasn't for me. People are always like, oh, why? I was just very immature when I chose a residency. Again, going back to
in your 20s, your frontal lobe is not done yet. You need to make massive decisions.
I'm happy to talk about this now because it's so far gone, but there is this weird thing that happens when you're a medical student. At least back in my day, the step one was not pass fail, it was like a scored thing.
That's right.
So there would be this like bias, subconscious bias for, the highest scores can go into XYZ field.
Yeah.
And if you don't do so well, your default is ABC field.
It's really absurd when you think about it.
Yeah. So as a student, I just found myself like out of a hat, just pulling out the specialty that I thought I deserved to go into.
Yeah.
I wish I'd liked it. It's a great field. You give people so much joy and hope, bringing back their vision. Uh-huh. And the surgical aspect and stuff was interesting, but it wasn't for me. And the more I've come to know myself, I don't like the cadence of work. Like I tell students now, I'm like, it's not always like surgical versus non-surgical. It's also, like, do you like outpatient medicine clinic, one patient after another, or something like I do that's like shift work, but I decide the flow of my day. I can go see 20 patients all at once and just power through it, or I can go downstairs and have coffee and lunch and then go back upstairs and up and down.
Spend more time with one patient if you want kind of thing.
It's like stuff that I didn't realize during my rotations. In medical school, what happens, I feel like, is either you get exposed to the most enthusiastic and inspiring attendings there are, or you get stuck with these curmudgeons that hate their lives and discourage you from going into that field. There's really no in between.
There's not academic.
Like,
yeah.
Every time now I talk to students, I'm like, I really like being a doctor. I enjoy patient care. It's such a privileged position. But I'm like, it doesn't matter what you do. At the end of the day, sometimes it turns into a job. And so I'm like, you have to choose a field, not based on the highlights. Like I used to think when I went into ophthalmology, well, I'm going to go to India and Africa and do these free cataract surgeries. And you can't live your life based on highlights, like a week or two, a month.
It's bread and butter.
Yeah, it's going to be the day in, day out, day in, day out. Can you go to work every single day, bring some skills and then gain purpose and be happy in your day-to-day life? And I couldn't do that as an ophthalmologist. I wish I could. But even now I tell students, it's not like puppy dogs and rainbows every single day, but I don't go home and Google my escape options, which is what I was doing before. So.
And I think that's worth talking about as well, because you are making these massive decisions in your 20s. And sometimes the specialty is not what you thought it was. And it is true that people can switch specialties. It does happen. And it's not necessarily the end of the world, though it might seem like it at the time. And I think people don't talk about that enough either.
Yeah, you know, because I ended up staying at the same hospital system. I stayed at NYU for medicine where I was for ophthalmology. Uh-huh. And it was probably a mistake staying at the same place, because every day the ER docs would be like, are you crazy? Why did you do that? And I had to occasionally run into my old ophtho department. Everything was on good terms, obviously, but it was just funny. If I was making that bigger change, I should have just changed institutions, because everyone has an opinion.
Right. And they look at the salary differential and think, oh, what were you thinking? But once again, there's more to life than salary. We're all going to be fine.
That's the other thing. Honestly, I, at that time, not that I could have powered through it and been an ophthalmologist, but I don't think I had any sense of what different specialties make. You know, I knew like ballpark, but now that I'm an internal medicine hospitalist, I'm like, oh, wow, retinal surgeons make triple what I do. but again, that's not a, for me at least, I could not have powered through it and just done it for the money.
Yeah.
But it does, I think that students do need to have a little bit of awareness, because if you like two specialties or two fields equally, honestly, in your heart, only you're the only one that can decide that.
Yeah.
And one pays double the other one. I don't know. Why wouldn't you explore the more lucrative one? Also, healthcare is changing every single year.
Yes.
I feel like healthcare systems and employers are trying to replace physicians with a lot of non-physician providers in the field.
Everywhere, all over. I think a lot of us have seen some of the consequences of that. I think that as a student, at least they need to be aware of that difference and have it just be a decision that they make. You know what? Actually, I know that other specialty pays double, but I'm choosing this one for this reason. At least just have thought about it. And I will say along those lines, another thing about being in the MD-PhD program, and I suspect this wasn't just my program, but it was definitely frowned upon and discouraged to even talk about money at all. You know, the idea was you're getting this stipend, and the idea of you getting this stipend is to allow you to work in academics forever where the salary would be less. So that's that. Don't think about it anymore. Don't question it. And if you start asking about money or thinking about money, oh, you're just greedy and you're just doing this for the money. which, as opposed to, you know what, maybe everyone just needs to have a full set of facts in front of them to make decisions.
Yeah, I really cringe when I hear other people talking about physician salaries sometimes, because we live in a society that like idealizes sports people that make tens of millions of dollars and no one blinks an eye, and entertainers and stuff. But
the hospital administration.
Yeah. But the moment physicians start advocating for themselves or negotiating, or suddenly we're money-minded. It's funny. I was actually on a call with a recruiter. I spent 20 minutes talking to this person, all the niceties and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the call, they said to me, I know you had listed this as your expected salary, but this is what we're offering. So if that's a deal breaker for you, I understand some people are just focused on the money. And I wanted to be like, what? Wow. You guys are a business. That's you were obviously focused on money. Like, well, but anyway, I held my tongue.
Taking advantage of your sense of not wanting to feel ashamed for thinking about it.
And I think that I've worked at like probably 10 different hospital systems the past like 12 years, because I did locums work and stuff and I moved around a lot. And healthcare systems really do tug on the heartstrings of doctors, because they, when they're short-staffed, they'll say stuff like, help out the team to get you to take extra shifts. Or there wasn't even a cost of living adjustment for 5 or 6 years in my hospitalist group until very recently, until a lot of people just handed in their resignation and left. And then suddenly the healthcare system was left scrambling. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times at AndWise, we talk about contract negotiations as well. I can't say that was something that was on my radar when I was graduating residency. I took the first locums rate that they offered me. And later on, a few years later, I was just frankly talking to one of the people in one of the Manhattan programs, and they were like, you realize that they get paid double. Like the company is making 50%, 100% more than what they're paying you.
For not seeing any patients, by the way.
Yeah.
Doing any of the actual work. There's a lot of money changing hands in this situation. Yeah, I didn't know that either. Yeah. Before I started doing locums, for sure.
Did you ever, in any of your full-time positions or anything, did you ever hire an attorney to look over your contract? Some people do, some people don't. Or...
You know, for my academic position, my husband's stepbrother, the lawyer, I just had him glance at it. But I think with academic contracts, gosh, it's its own world, because for better or for worse, at least where I worked, the salaries were kept uniform, which there are some benefits to that, so that you don't have some people that are just better negotiators or that just get paid more somewhat arbitrarily, that kind of levels the playing field. So everyone who is in attending starting at that year in that specialty, that there's one set of money. So there's some benefit to that. But on the flip side of it, when academics, there's not a whole lot you can really truly set in stone. Like the contract is quite vague. There was nothing actually in writing about, okay, you have this grant that's going to protect this percentage of your time, so you're not going to see any patients for that day a week. That was all just like a handshake and a verbal situation. And maybe I tried to write it out in an email at some point, so something that's written. But at the end of the day, the academic group decides what you do. And that's the deal. But like you were saying, okay, if some number of people are out or quit or whatever, okay, then everyone else is just going to need to do more clinic. And that's the thing. And because I had done the MD-PhD program, I hadn't really thought of anything outside of academics. But okay, this is clearly our only option. when it turns out it's really not. And I think for anyone else out there that transitions from academia into the private world, like I have, you definitely have to shift your thinking from, okay, I'm going to make the salary, there's nothing I can do about it, to all of a sudden, you need to be aware of what you should be asking for and talk with other people about what they make and ask for a fair number, because otherwise that company, that private enterprise, is really just profiting off of you.
Yeah.
Excessively.
It's absolutely. Yeah, I feel like academics or private or everyone is profiting off physicians.
Oh, there's definitely. Even at those academic hospitals, those hospital admins are doing great. Those salaries go up and up and up. And people don't seem up in arms about that because they just don't know.
And they're also happy to, aside from administrators, who I'm no big fan of for their C-suite bonuses, but aside from that, the academic not-for-profit healthcare systems are also happy to take revenue and build nicer lobbies, expand their real estate footprint, market on television, radio, social media. But the moment it comes to negotiating with physicians, it's, oh, this is what it is. Boilerplate, take it or leave it. A lot of the, when I finished residency.
Considered.
That's right. That's right. There's this whole gaslighting about, like, how could you possibly want to negotiate? We have 10 people lined up here that would kill for this job.
The prestige of working at this institution.
Right.
Which, by the way, that prestige doesn't pay for anything. It doesn't pay your mortgage. It doesn't actually do anything.
When I finished residency, the Manhattan academic programs were all paying 20% less than right over the bridge in New Jersey or Long Island or whatever.
Yeah, I believe that.
Your commute probably would have been 35 minutes. And depending on if you have a partner, spouse, whatever, if you're single, some people psychologically don't want to be outside of Manhattan. But mathematically, a lot of times it doesn't make sense to work at these places unless you're doing something that's specific to those institutions. Mm-hmm. They're just 20% is a lot of money, and compounded over like a 20, 30 year career, it's a fortune. It's
huge. But if you've been conditioned for your entire academic life that prestige is somehow the top criteria for no reason, but you've just been, because you train in an academic center, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the mindset that you're really surrounded with, then you can really buy into that. I can see how easily you can buy into that. And I did for quite a while until I actually stopped and thought about it. Wait, what does prestige actually give to me? What do I care about that? I actually really don't care. Within full-time academics, you rise these ranks from assistant professor to associate professor and full professor. These very, there's these very small bumps in salary with each of these. And I finally thought about it and just thought, I don't care. I don't care about these terms. These words are meaningless outside of this building and have no bearing on my life. Why is this the new rat race that I'm running, trying to rise these rungs that are completely meaningless?
No, exactly. I'm totally with you. It's okay to change your mind as well. Like, I was into that at the start of my career. I thought maybe one day I would be like CMO, like I'd be the chief medical officer. I was medical director for a group for 5 years. And then when our third child was born, I was like, you know what? I don't want any of this. I want to take care of my patients. I enjoy patient care. But after that, I'm done. I want to be done with my day and spend time with family. So all of the things you're talking about, I'm totally on board 100% with you. But there are other people that love that stuff. And you know what?
Sure.
If you like it, go for it. Just be an informed player in the system. Know what you are getting, what you're giving up, how you can negotiate. And enjoy. We need people like that as well. We need people to be CMOs and CEOs and whoever
it takes all kinds, because do what is best for you, though. Be a little selfish. It's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. On that note, we're coming up on time. I really appreciate all of your insights. I really enjoyed talking to you.
That was so fun.
Do you have any parting words for those couple of years behind, many years behind? Any final thoughts before we end?
Try your best to take away the expectations of everyone else. Pretend like everyone else just moved to another country for whatever reason, and really trying to think what would make you fulfilled in life. It's hard to do in your 20s, but try to do it.
I love it. Dr. Nath, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is there a preferred place you want people to reach out? Is LinkedIn the best? Twitter? What do you like?
LinkedIn is fine.
If they have questions?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter at Audrey Nath, MD, PhD. Either is fine.
We will post your links in the show notes. Thanks again. Really appreciate it.